Hey, you've tuned in to Taking It Down. I'm the editor-in-chief of the website, The Alabama Take. I am Blaine Duncan, and Taking It Down is The Alabama Take's pop culture podcast. Today, we're talking about two HBO shows, I May Destroy You and Perry Mason. Then after the break, we're going to talk about the new Spike Lee film now on Netflix, The Five Bloods. It was originally supposed to be a theatrical release, but released on Netflix instead because of COVID. Anyway, joining me today is co-host and contributor to the website, Adam Morrow, and our frequent, lovable guest, Donovan Reinwald's here. And you guys are kind of wanting to talk about Lane Kiffin and Mike Leach.
It's been a big weekend in Mississippi, hadn't it?
Yeah. I would like to go on the record that I would rather talk about the PP man than either Mike Leach or Lane Kiffin. Hey, also, another question for you.
Why have you called a college athlete the PP man?
He raised his leg to do a PP. He's the PP man.
I mean, I guess if you do that, then you have opened yourself up to become
he's the PP man. Is it possible that Mike Leach, although he's been doing better lately, will he coach a game? Or is he going to retweet something insane? And then, you know, it's like, well, he never coached the game. You know, like, he gave it a good try, but he couldn't handle being around anyone but his immediate family at all.
That's what we call the old Mike Price.
Leach would do something far more depressing, though. You know, like, Price is funny looking back on it, but Leach is... You know, he's quirky and funny and weird, but also I feel like he probably is maybe a little upset that the subreddit, The Donald, got shut down today. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Is he a Trumper?
He seems kind of like the, I don't want to project too much, but he seems definitely like, well, you know, there's interesting things out there, and like, he may just fall down that kind of rabbit hole.
You know, I bet he has some fun thoughts about 9/11.
Yeah, he just seems like he's kind of out there.
JD, too. Like, he's got a law degree and everything. He's wild.
Crazy.
Yeah. Crazy.
Fun thoughts on 9/11.
We were talking before we started up here about the timeline that started with that Ole Miss player raising his leg.
The PP man.
To pee after scoring the... That game was so funny. I can't remember where in... Was that the go-ahead touchdown or was it the...
Yeah, that was right at the end.
Yeah. That led to... Somehow, Mike Leach and Lane Kiffin finding themselves in rural Mississippi and taking control of these programs, and now they are probably not going to play their first year, or at least play a very weird season if they do, and have been instrumental in taking down remnants of the Confederacy in the Deep South. This is not what I expected. 2020 has its bright spots, I guess.
I think I'm getting a news flash here. You know, Lane Kiffin, he drove his F-350 to the square, and he's got a chain hooked up to the monument right now. Lane has not done the math right, so if he pulls it over, it's coming down right on him. But damn, that man is brave.
That would be more of a Mike Leach movie. Yeah.
Shit, we can take that down.
could be Mike Leach, like a Lane Kiffin mask, you know, like Scooby-Doo style.
If this is your first time tuning in, Taking It Down is not a taking it down as in Confederate monuments, though we're all for that. That we're actually taking down what we think about pop culture. And the first thing on the docket today is the new HBO show, Perry Mason. And... it's aired 2 episodes thus far, and I've seen them both. Guys, where are we on this?
I'm at number 1. I didn't have time today to watch number 2.
Okay.
Same here.
It was the biggest debut for HBO in like 2 or 3 years.
What the hell else has anyone got to do?
Well, you know, that should be true, but here's the deal. You know, everybody's out and about and doing whatever the hell they want. I think life is back to normal despite a pandemic.
Well, it depends on where you live.
Yeah, right. So, anyway, we got Perry Mason being that surprised me, though. The biggest debut for HBO in a few years. And we got Matthew Reese, a stellar cast, but of course Matthew Reese is the center point, and he is playing a taciturn divorcee World War One vet. This is Perry Mason. If you're even familiar with the name at all, you know the probably black and white version from childhood. If you're my age, you might have seen those in syndication, but I never watched those. But we got Matthew Rhys playing a brand new version, and it is almost Perry Mason in name only. Yeah,
absolutely. He's not a lawyer yet. You know, he's a PI. It's in color. your parents probably won't like it, or your grandparents.
And why? Why do you think that? Let's start there. Why wouldn't?
You're really cutting out my "I can't wait until HBO reboots Matlock" joke.
You know, I would watch it.
There's been a lot of action.
the griff.
Let's take the implied out and just show it.
Definitely. Well, you know, if you're, I don't think this is a spoiler. It's in the trailer for the show. If your family is into baby violence, then they'll probably love it. But that might be a little much for your mom, you know.
Yeah,
it was a lot. Really,
yeah, opening scene involves some harm to a 2 month, 3 month old baby.
It's very Lindbergh baby, right?
Right. So yeah. Kidnapping gone awry, perhaps, and that's the basis of the show. That's how it gets going with Perry Mason becoming involved in the investigation of that. He actually works for John Lithgow's character, who's a lawyer. His name's E.B. the lawyer, and he hires out Perry Mason, Matthew Rhys, and sometimes hires out Shay Whigham's character. Mm-hmm. Who turns out to be one of Perry Mason's mentors as far as being a PI. So not only Lithgow, but we've got one of my favorite That Guy actors. I should know his name. I should have looked up his name. But he was a detective on the Netflix show Unbelievable. And and Donovan, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Yep. But He played the cuckold husband on Escape at Dannemora and was fantastic on that. I mean, played a completely different guy. And so much so that I had to look him up when I was watching that show. I was like, who is this guy? Because he had fake teeth in that I honestly didn't know were fake at the time. And anyway, he played the cuckolded husband there on that miniseries. But who else am I forgetting about on this show? Because it's like every...
Well, if you've hit episode two, which I have not, you've got Tatiana Maslany in the show as well, which I was excited to see her because I haven't seen her do anything for a while now. But she's a very good actor.
From Orphan Black, right? Mainly, that's her?
Yep, and I felt like she was... She didn't quite have the writing and show direction around her in that show to really, she was way outshining what they were giving her. You know, she was better than the product, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, all right, let's go around. Let's go around and talk about episode one, general thoughts and why, you know, Adam, you haven't said a lot. What are you thinking about the new Perry Mason?
Well, I think the vibe was really enjoyable to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I was immediately kind of sucked into the world that they're creating. They're obviously playing with old California, old Los Angeles. And a lot of shows seem to do that. And you always think, well, this is, in a way, self-referential, you know? And sometimes that can be a chore. Sometimes it's a joy. But in this one, I think even, like, the landscape of him going to the old family farm, you know, all of the... Everything from the cityscapes to the more rural areas that we would laugh about being rural now. I really enjoyed that, enjoyed the vibe. I thought the construction of kind of as you're getting facts, you know, it's noir. So there has to be an art to how you're discovering information. I really enjoyed that. My only hang up, and this is almost a joke, is they're all wearing the same hats. And there's like a bunch of white dudes who are either cops or investigators or lawyers. And like that was a little hard to follow in this kind of shadowy show. I'm sure that I'll get up the pace on that by episode two. And I don't mind being a little lost on episode one of a program. It kind of makes it more rewarding at times if it's done the right way. Mm-hmm. If it's not done the right way, then it's the early cracks starting to show. But I have a feeling this one is trending in the right direction.
I'll jump in quickly and just say, before we get to Donovan, that I had a very similar problem, and that final scene, there's a final scene. I won't spoil episode one yet. Maybe we'll put a spoiler warning up in a few minutes, but there's a scene at the very end that I thought one of the characters who gets harmed was a character from earlier, and episode two will clear that up for you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
So, Donovan, first episode thoughts.
I have the same problem sometimes. With like any like Band of Brothers, I still have no idea which any character is because they all are dirty and white and they all look the same. So I'm right there. So one of the absolutely crucial things that they're doing is making his only mode of transportation a milk truck that he drives around LA, and that's just beyond brilliant, right? But I agree with Adam, though. Like, the production value is really solid, and it's, you know, they're doing it. I feel like they're doing it in a way where they're kind of showing their influences without being entirely too cute about it. You know, there's scenes and, like, camera setups that imitate, like, The Big Sleep. And then, you know, they throw it, right? Like, they've got a Fatty Arbuckle character. You know, they've got a lot of fun stuff. But for me, the absolute linchpin is Matthew Rhys is a really good performer, and I think, like, it's almost like sometimes I'm like, is he a good actor or is his sad face just really effective on me? Because, like, he has a certain way of, like, you know, especially in this show, he doesn't actually talk a lot too much, and he has some good one-liners, but there's not a lot of dialogue, so it's more in the way he moves. He looks tired. He looks old. He looks sad.
He's just a haggard Zach Braff, is what.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, he looks sad in a way that, like, you're kind of like, you know, almost compare it to the way John Hamm can kind of just look stone-faced, but, like, he looks like there's stuff going on in there, and I like the way that Matthew Rhys can kind of switch it on a dime, but he doesn't do it in an Al Pacino way. You know, he'll switch on a dime or explode, and it seems really scary because you didn't expect it coming from this guy. Yeah, so I think he's just phenomenal. I just want to watch him.
The one time that fell a little flat to me, and I guess we'll get a little spoilery here. I won't even provide the context if we're.
I'll tell you what,
unless we want to jump in.
No, let's do it. If you haven't seen episode one, we're going to spoil episode one. We won't spoil episode two since you guys haven't seen it either. But yeah, here we go.
Just that when he has had the rough series of events and ends mm-hmm. up drunk back at the family homestead, that scene went on for so long to me. Like, him drunk and stumbling around and kind of working, like trying to call his ex-wife uh-huh. and trying to talk to his kid. And it was all like affecting, but it just kept going. I was like, all right, we get it. This dude, he's been through it.
Yeah.
That's the only time that I had an issue with pacing or anything like that.
The anger there worked for me at the end, but I didn't, you know, just kind of the where he explodes and like destroys the fire truck, because it is a little kind of like scary, angry dad, you know. But agreed. Also, it's the only sex scene I've seen this year where someone fell off the bed. So more of that, please, HBO. That was my favorite scene in the
very
movie,
funny
in the whole show. Yeah,
two hilarious sex scenes.
Absolutely.
You talk about Matthew Rhys holding that very effective sad face, and he even holds it during sex.
And he's slipping between the bed and the wall,
and his arm is just up.
And his face isn't changing at all. It's great. More of that, please, HBO.
And more of Natalie was in the other room, and I was like, hey, I need to watch this before tomorrow. And I didn't realize, I was like, I'll watch the first 10 minutes. We know the general outline of this story, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of noir. Like, I'll just tell you the inciting events. Okay. So what she missed was the baby, the kidnapping. And I told her it was pretty rough, you know, there was, mm-hmm. it went awry, but then trying to illustrate exactly where Perry is in life, they have him taking pictures on the morality cross thing, and there's like, it's like, well, there's a sex scene, and there's a lot of cake and food, and then a large naked man runs chasing a truck. I don't know, it was I chose a hell of a thing to try to, I felt like that scene in Parks and Rec where Andy is like trying to explain Rambo, you remember that? but it hell of a thing to try to tell, but very funny.
So, yeah, if you ever wanted to see Fatty Arbuckle and Rita Hayworth together, you know, this is your time.
There you go.
Donovan brought up a stellar idea that I hope somebody's listening and can get this done. If we can get John Hamm in season two, Matthew Rhys and John Hamm on the same screen, psh, take my money, you know?
It's over.
How many words per minute are in that scene?
Two.
70 yeah. an episode.
Yeah.
But there is a, this is a good show, I thought. I've been listening to a couple of reviewers and reading a couple of reviews based on the show. That covered episode one, and it's getting some dings. It's getting some dings, but everyone's praising the production value, as are we.
Looks great. It could go off the rails, you know, five episodes in, because you know it's all set up at this point. So you know you gotta give me the payoff. But I don't know. I feel like you're doing a neo noir. You get a little slack from me.
Okay, yeah, and that was maybe one of the things I think people were pushing up against. They were saying. To the Trey Irby, I'll just quote Trey on Twitter, our friend and writer on the Alabama Take. He basically said that it was Perry Mason in a Sin City spin, and I don't think that's the case. That's not how I walked away from it.
I mean, and this might sound insane because we haven't seen the end. What it reminded me of was more like Perry Mason in Chinatown, just in the sense that it's kind of adding in. It is a noir, and it's recognizably a noir, but then, you know, Chinatown did some stuff in the 70s that they obviously weren't able to do in the 40s and 50s. Although, you know, the thing is, if you watch old noirs, that stuff is all there. You know, you might not see it, but it's, you know, like, look at The Big Sleep. You know, there's pornographers, and, you know, there's drugs, and, you know, there's murder. You know, there's a lot of violence. I mean, these were, you know, a lot of, it's in there. Now, if you have a lot of affection and fondness for Perry, like the character of Perry Mason, for whatever reason, which I personally don't.
What person under 100 would?
Right. You know, maybe this is getting you all grumpy, but I really have no, you know, I'm more like, oh, cool. They're taking, you know, this property they had lying around and letting Matthew Rhys be in a noir. And it had more of the kind of Chinatown and onward, you know, or like, say, in a different genre, right? Like what Clint Eastwood did in Unforgiven, right? Like the stuff is all there already, but now he's depicting it. So I and it's nowhere near as violent as Sin City, for one thing.
Yeah. I did find it baffling that they just chose to use Perry Mason as the entryway to this. It seems like it could be a show unto itself, sans Perry Mason. You know what I mean?
Agreed. I wonder, there's part of me that wonders, is like, was somebody's copyright expiring somewhere? Like if CBS or whoever has the rights wants to throw it in as a bonus on CBS All Access or something, did they have to throw a little money towards this and get it happening? I have no idea. It's bizarre, but I don't really care. Besides, like, how weird, Perry Mason in 2020.
And I did question, this is all first episode stuff, which my opinion actually shifts in the second episode, from watching the second episode. I question if they were overplaying the dour mood. You know, we got another dead child. That's like the third dead child we've seen on television.
Not a good show to be a child on HBO.
No, because it's the third one, the ones that we've covered. The second episode to me, and I'll be incredibly general, is just really good. So some of the basics, you know, we can kind of touch on is the first episode opens with these two parents, this man and wife, who are watching from a window the possibility of trying to get their kidnapped 3-month-old back. And you know, they get a phone call and, you know, they can go and do it, drop off the money, blah, blah, blah. And when they get on this trolley where they're supposed to pick up the baby, they get to the baby and the baby's something like we keep saying something went awry because we don't know. All we know is that they pick up the baby and the baby has died somewhere along the way. And it seems as though it might have happened much earlier than when they picked it up because the baby's eyes have been sewn shut.
Not a lot of coloration going on either.
No.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, Perry Mason gets roped in and that's where it goes from there. Is that too dour for you guys? Was that too much? Was the dead baby stuff a step too far?
It kind of makes sense. Like what Donovan was saying, that there's always been in these noir settings, like maybe at a different time it had to be implied. But it's always been a dark thing. You know, it's supposed to be seedy.
If you're casting around for, like, in the imagined time period, right? You know, the Lindbergh baby was a real thing. So I'm kind of wondering if they're playing off stuff like that. And then the other thing, too, is it was an incredibly effective in media res kind of scene, but it's over in about 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. So you have something kind of if we had been there for 15 minutes, maybe it would have been like, ugh. But, you know, it's kind of like your hook. And then it gets you, I don't want to just watch that, but it left me kind of like, it's like, okay, like who would kill a baby, right? Like, how is this involved? You know, it's a good kind of like, this doesn't fit kind of setup, you know?
And we start to get the idea that maybe the parents were involved somehow.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a little later when the investigators come into the scene. And then at the very end of the episode, we understand that one of the investigators is involved somehow as well, because he goes and gets the money and ends up shooting other people who are apparently helping with the kidnapping or were helping.
Yeah, I thought that was the scene that I had trouble keeping track of all of our...
Absolutely.
All of our white dudes.
Like, wait, who's this pulling the trigger?
Did you think one of the guys shot was the dad?
I had a second where I was like, is that the dad? And then,
But it was not.
And then I'm like, I don't think it is. The dad.
It was a little different. Yeah, I did too. And it took the opening of the second episode will clear that up pretty very quickly. So, no. Yeah, that's another classic noir thing where the bad cop, right?
Yep, absolutely.
How high up does this go, right?
Oh, I was going to say, it's like the Chinatown thing, right? Another Los Angeles thing, right? But he has to go to City Hall, right? And go through the, you know, so that's, it felt very, you know, it's doing stuff in that vein. It's mining that vein there.
Well, and he's already said, I wouldn't trust the cops with this.
Yeah. Kind of, you know, something, and this is neither here nor there. You can cut this if you want, Blaine. But I did think it was kind of coincidentally interesting that something like this, a neo-noir with sort of an older view of the police and policing in America, was coming out right at this moment. Because, you know, if you watch these old noirs, you know, the police are kind of, you're never really sure with them, right? And then there's a lot of these, you know, even the stuff in the 70s, like in The Long Goodbye, right? The main character gets, you know, he's in a police station and he's beaten, you know, the PI is beaten by the police and stuff. So it is kind of interesting at this moment where I think a lot of people are questioning the role, you know, like even Paw Patrol's under fire, right? That there is like a kind of alternative, older tradition of depictions of policing in America that have sort of fallen along the wayside, especially post-Reagan.
I mean, I thought Rambo had the final word on this.
And then episode two will do something with race. So, you know.
Interesting.
Hang on there.
Well, and the other thing that seems to be, not to keep digging this back in, the religion thing seems to be swirling. We hadn't talked about that yet, that the reason that some of these key players know each other is through a church, right? Or an organization of some kind. And there's a portrait of the matriarch, I guess, of this, right? Whatever she is, it appears a couple times. And that's got to mean something going forward.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, because that's Maslany's character there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something hit me in the middle of episode one where I thought, okay, I see what the critics are saying and I'm kind of in agreement, but this could turn out to be a stellar work. Maybe at the end of season one, we'd find that this is excellent, or it could also be one of those where season two and beyond become like really, really good television. Not that it's not now, it's expensive as hell, that's for sure, but it's pretty good. It's very intriguing and, you know, it's grown on me. And that might be episode two talking there, but yeah, for sure. I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, I'm in for the ride.
You know, episode one kept me wanting more, which, you know, at the end of the day, what more can you really ask for a TV show review? Did you want to watch the next episode? Yeah, I did.
All right. Speaking of HBO, let's shift gears a little into I May Destroy You. I think we're all both, I say both, two episodes in, and I think mm-hmm. there are probably mm-hmm. four episodes at this point. So we've watched half of the episodes that are out. And of course, well, I'm taking into consideration that this podcast comes out on Tuesday. So by the time this episode of our podcast drops, I May Destroy You will have aired four. Just an overview on this one. It's made in conjunction with BBC. It's a British dramedy, I guess. I know a lot of people hate that word, but we got a sort of a comedy slash drama going on. 30-minute show. HBO airs it, and it stars the lady from, if you're familiar with the Netflix show Chewing Gum, and she's a writer working to finish a chapter or something in a book. She's on deadline. She's coming in from Italy, where they have paid her to go and perhaps research, but really she's going to visit a boyfriend or a possible boyfriend. And there's some issues there. She gets back. She's trying to work. She gets distracted. She's got friends texting her. She goes out. And I'll kind of leave it there before we jump into spoilers. I went into this show really blind, other than I knew Adam had mentioned this. He made a statement in the last episode that I May Destroy You deals with big issues. I forgot how you phrased it, Adam.
Well, I mean, I feel like there's a lot going on. Just off the bat, you know.
No, I just thought that I think you might have said dark issues, and that's all I knew, is that it was going to deal with something heavy, and you don't really know what that heavy thing is until the final scene of the show, I think, and then of the first episode, that is. So, what did you guys think about this? I May Destroy You.
I wasn't able to get to this one, so I'll have to sit this out.
Oh,
okay. So we'll talk about it in sort of vague.
No, spoilers are not a problem. I sort of know what's going on with the show.
It's Michaela Cole, by the way, is the actress whom I should have credited earlier. But Michaela Cole from Chewing Gum, if you know, but she wrote and stars in this. And it's about a sexual assault somewhat, but it's also about a woman having a life as a writer, I think. There's a lot of that going on so far, because that assault thing ends up propelling episode two, but it doesn't propel episode one. It's not until the final scene where you realize that happened, or may have happened even, right?
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, the whole thing feels, you know, her life up until then, I feel like having episode one work the way that it did was so that we have a clear picture of who this person is
mm-hmm.
before this horrible incident happens. And mm-hmm. she lives a very, I don't know, free-flowing, kind of frenetic, high-energy kind of life in London. I mean, life is pretty good if you're a writer who lives in London and that's that's all you're doing, you know, and you have money to go out and all these things, and like things, it's a good life. And she seems very keyed in on, you know, people stop her in the street. She's like a social media kind of icon in addition to this writer. And I kept thinking about Girls. Like she has achieved what all of the women and girls thought they were going to achieve. You know, the opening line in Girls, I'm not sure that I am the voice of a generation, but how does she phrase that? Anyway, it seems that she has, the protagonist here has kind of turned into this actual like millennial icon kind of woman. And then this awful thing happens, and I guess we'll jump into episode two as well, but it paints her life as she has a pretty wide friend group. They have a lot of fun together, different corners of this friend group. And when this awful thing happens, all of that starts to fracture. So not only is the kind of the carefree, like stay out all night, have fun stuff, does that kind of get put into question, but also she's wondering who she can trust.
Yeah, for sure. It there's a bit of a whodunit kind of aspect to it, especially in episode two, which makes it, despite the horrible incident, despite the sexual assault, makes it incredibly intriguing and propulsive.
I wonder if we're supposed to know more, because I mean, I clearly remember the guy from the first episode that she keeps flashing back to. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. We all remember him from, but she was in a, like she was drunk, or she was, and she seems drugged, perpetually stoned. So she already had kind of a cocktail going on anyway. And then, but even before if we assume that the shots were spiked, like mm-hmm. I remember him being there before that, but maybe it was just like, she's with a bunch of people, you know, she's not that, you know, this gets into a weird area of like, what does she remember from that night? What does she remember before being spot? All these kind of things, and how that I felt like the her trying to deal with it and having these flashbacks, and then finally that one crushing moment when it she seems to accept what has happened when she actually goes to the police,
right?
And is in that room, and she it's very affecting. She pulls her shirt up over her eyes or the collar of her shirt and just starts sobbing when she finally kind of pieces it together. But you're right, it is still kind of a whodunit, and you know, she goes to friends who are not helpful, people that she was with the night before that are just totally won't even tell her where she was and where they were. So she's piecing together, you know, who of her friends she can trust, because a lot of them were there, or some of them were there. There were strangers there as well, but I don't know. It's that scene was just so moving and crushing, and but she's also kind of going through a lot of these motions with the sense of detachment that I think is both part of, I don't want to speak to trauma that I can't understand, but I know trauma, you kind of have an out of body experience where you're trying to process it in some way, or maybe your brain and body aren't letting you yet. But also her natural pose seems to be kind of that ironic detachment, like mm-hmm. even before the incident. So it's, I don't know how she handles it going forward. It'll be a 6-episode run total. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the, we talked about Perry Mason, that has a very clear cut. There is something trying to be accomplished. Like, is this an invest? Does it matter who did it? Like, obviously it matters, but is the show more about who is covering up or who is not helpful?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it is partly a part of the narrative, but this is an incident that happened to Michaela Cole in real life, I think. So she's using her own experience, sadly, and depicting it, I think, as realistically as we've seen, maybe since Unbelievable on Netflix, maybe. So it's there are aspects of this that is obviously a tough watch, but this show also had this vibe for me that made me want to continue to watch, like, because we're in the same boat as the point of view character. We don't know what happened. All we know is there were shots, and then she wakes up in her office, and that's, and we want the blanks filled in for us as viewers, and we want this guy, multiple people perhaps, caught, you know. So there's,
it's rough. And it's also, you know, they're using it as a way to look into all these lives. Kind of the weird love triangle that's happening with her friend Simon, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And his wife.
God knows what's going on there.
Who knows? He's having some sort of affair is all we know. But anyway.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into specifics because I feel like we can come back and look at this clearer.
Yeah.
With a few more episodes under our belt, if not all of them.
Yeah.
It's a 6-episode run, like you mentioned, so it should be a fast show.
It should be. And it seemed at first, and I'll just to echo what you said, kind of my last thoughts on it, that it would be a painful watch, probably a very good watch, but a painful watch. And it's managed to stay funny despite the issues at hand, and managed to stay kind of vibrant. And, you know, I'm watching this glimpse into a facet of London culture that's interesting to me. And, you know, I think especially this being on BBC One, you know, Britain is not without its own issues, just like we have, and prominently featuring a mostly black cast, and her best friend is gay. And, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, what we would call pearl clutching would probably happen here, from maybe some regular BBC viewers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was even, you know, the Premier League, the soccer league there has been playing with jerseys. There are no player names on the back. They just say Black Lives Matter. And somebody flew a plane, rented a plane, and flew it over the Manchester City Stadium with the banner behind it, All Lives Matter.
Idiots.
You know, I mean, you see racist folks, and this soccer is my way of viewing that music into British culture. So I feel like that's the one glimpse I have, but I have to imagine based on some of the resistance to the Black Lives Matter movement, that maybe this is We picture Europe and other places as maybe more progressive than we are, but this may be more of a statement than we think it is, if that makes sense.
No, I agree. And you talked about it being a little funny outside of the assault and rape part of the story. It is kind of funny. It has some humorous moments, and that's all attributed to Michaela Cole, who writes this show. And, you know, the idea here is that she is not her definition of herself is not the assault. I think that's partly what we're getting there.
Yeah. And she's funny. Okay.
No, she is.
She is funny in addition to her writing. I'm excited. I'm excited to finish it.
She's quirky and funny. And so it's a very propulsive watch. And it's I can't wait to see what more it does and how it kind of wraps. I think it's going to be a good show. All right, let's take a break. And we're going to come back on the other side. Speaking of Black Lives Matter, we're going to talk about the Five Bloods, which ends up being very related to that. All right. Okay, this is an ad break. We put ads here right now. We're advertising ourselves. Go find us on your podcast app and give us stars and reviews and love and subscriptions and make us feel good. Also, check out more on the website that brings you all of this shit. We got thealabamatake.com. No, we're back. That was it. Short ad break. We're talking about The Five Bloods, which is on Netflix, not intentionally on Netflix, I don't think. It was supposed to be a theatrical release from Spike Lee this summer. And so that, of course, went astray, totally off course. But we get it on Netflix. So there is a lot going on in this movie. A lot. And we'll generalize and then spoiler, you know, right after that. We've got four Vietnam veterans, four Black Vietnam veterans, hugely important that they are Black men, going back to Vietnam to recover the remains of a fallen compadre, right? And kind of a mentor to them even. And so they're back in Vietnam to try to find his remains. There's more than that.
Ostensibly to find his remains.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we find out that there's probably more to it than that. I won't get into quite, that might even be spoiler territory, not sure. And so what we have is this introduction to them, and then they get out in the jungle, and they, you know, things happen from there. And again, on the general level, this movie is dealing with Vietnam and war in general and how poor people die in wars. That's war in a nutshell. It's rich people sending poor people to go fight. It's been the case since probably the beginning of time. It's a look at Black men or men in general and how they deal with trauma. It is a movie about friendship. And I want to talk about maybe that aspect of the theme it was running. One of the huge through lines, again, was capitalism and how that controls our actions, everyone's actions almost, I suppose. And that's what I feel like the movie was, and Spike Lee was kind of getting at. There's a lot more than that that I probably missed. But I will say that I might end up talking myself into loving this movie at the end of this podcast, but I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. I really wanted to, I wanted to love this movie, and I loved the messages that Spike Lee was cooking into the movie, but it just didn't, it didn't capture me. It didn't grab me by the collar and shake me. Like, I feel like it could have had a couple of different things happen, but I'm here to judge what was on the screen, I guess. And it just, I think I'm going to talk myself into loving it, but I wanted to love it upon watching. So that's where I'll start.
Is it Spike's style? Cause I think it's kind of uncontroversial to say that Spike Lee kind of makes a Shaggy movie, you know, like there's a lot, and it's all thrown in, and you know, some of it works better than others, you know. I think all of his movies.
Do the Right Thing is probably still one of my favorite films by him. It's got to be, and it feels it feels the least Shaggy. I like that adjective.
Yeah.
Yeah, he definitely makes Shaggy movies, and that makes sense to me.
Because did you see you saw Black Klansman?
No, I haven't. Okay. I read the book, but I haven't watched the movie.
So I'd recommend the movie, but it does kind of have that, you know, I think with Spike's, with Black Klansman in this film, you could say, you could take almost any scene in the movie, you know, you could strip down except quote unquote essential scenes, and you'd probably have a 75-minute movie. And the rest of them, you could probably say, what was this scene for? But, you know, I was kind of watching it with the thought of like, well, what would you cut? Because it starts to be like, what is any scene for, really? You know, like, he makes big shaggy movies, and that's what he does.
I do think Black Klansman seemed to be a little bit tighter of a film in that regard, to me. But I agree, there's always an adjustment period with his movies where you kind of have to remember that he is unafraid to collage styles.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, editing in old historical clips in ways that are more jarring than we're used to, or having side stories that are explored briefly and then not returned to, kind of to make a point. Like, he's unafraid of being cliche, you know, where like maybe other people would shy away from, you know, having like the North Vietnamese radio host tell them, I guess we're getting into spoiler territory here.
Yeah, it's in the trailer.
Yeah. I tell you what, let's do this. We'll come back to the radio person.
Okay.
And just tweet length. Did you like it or not? So Adam, we'll go with you and then Donovan, because I've already said that I kind of liked it, but I didn't love it.
I'm going to go strongly enjoyed.
I'm going to say hell yeah.
Okay. All right. And then, so get back to that radio announcer. So here's our spoilers. We're going to dissect the movie a little bit. So if you haven't seen it, come back to this part.
Well, just using her as an example of, you know, she is the one who delivers the news that Martin Luther King has been assassinated. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the Vietnam movie has been done so many times, and MLK is been co-opted by literally every group in America at this point. And him being unafraid, Spike Lee being unafraid to have this scene still have importance, illustrates to me that he's a guy who's really not worried about like what culture at large would call cliche or what, or having, you know, say towards the end of the movie, Paul, the Delroy Lindo character, speak directly into the camera when that hasn't happened the whole time. Like, he's not afraid of, he's serving a point in a story, not necessarily like wanting to be tied to an art form or a specific formula for that art form.
Makes a lot of sense.
He's certainly not like a neo-realist filmmaker, right? Like, and he's not afraid. Yeah. And there were a couple things, you know, like who else but Spike Lee practically, you know, Quentin Tarantino does it, but he does it in a very different way. Who else but Spike Lee could say, I'm doing Apocalypse Now right now. Y'all look at me doing we got the music. We're on the river. I'm doing this is my Apocalypse Now moment.
I mean, there was even an Apocalypse Now banner behind that was, before that they had their like dance.
Incredible.
Yeah. The bar was called Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Who else could say, have a character go, oh, I don't need no stinking badges, you know, Treasure of the Sierra Madre stuff, you know, like, he's like, what? I mean, it's almost like so brave, you know, like Quentin seems like, you know, sorry, Quentin, I love you. This is great. But sometimes, like, he's a little too cool for school, film nerdy, where Spike is too. But it's just like he almost seems like more brazen about it sometimes.
Yeah,
like,
he sometimes he'll throw up a giant signpost that says, "This is the reference I'm making, and this is how I'm playing with it."
Yeah, one of the characters even referenced Rambo.
Yeah,
which was in like the Green Berets and that kind of stuff. Have you ever watched a Vietnam movie that even referenced Martin Luther King as if he was in the same universe as Vietnam?
I don't. In fact, I was thinking about what black movie, like what movie allowed black people to talk about and deal with that in reference to Vietnam. And I can't think of one. Mad Men did it, but that is like a white show. That is a thoroughly white show for the most part. And they didn't deal with it in terms of Vietnam.
One of the only movies I've ever seen that dealt with anything like this is Samuel Fuller's The Steel Helmet, which came out right at the beginning of the Korean War. And it's a great film. Criterion's got it. It may be on HBO Max at this point. I'd recommend it. But, you know, they captured this unit captures a North Korean soldier. And there's a black man and a Japanese man in this American unit. And the North, kind of in the same way Hanoi Hannah does here, says, why the heck are you two fighting for these? They locked you up and they don't give you equal rights. Why are you fighting with these? And, you know, that's almost the only thing I've ever seen that does anything like that. Because I think there's something really powerful about, you know, kind of the communist propaganda mouthpiece saying something that you can't refute. What is America offering that's so great to these frontline soldiers getting killed so that, you know, what do they call him? President Fake Bone Spurs can, you know, get his exemption or President, you know, Air National Guard can fly planes in Texas. Hmm. What are we offering that's so good?
You know, one of the criticisms that I want to briefly maybe touch on is obviously the whole thing has a Heart of Darkness, Apocalypse Now kind of thing. They say early that somebody says money is the root of all evil, and you see that play out, and that's an easy story. But the irony that they are, and I know that this is intentional, they are aware of the way that their country has used them and their brothers and exploited them, but at the same time, they're not exactly the most tolerant of the Vietnamese at that point.
Yeah.
Nor are they, has it broken, you know, if you want to talk about the original sins of America, slavery is obviously number one, but all of that is money driven. Money is the root of all evil. That's surely everybody, regardless of creed or religion, can say, you know, there's something that holds a little bit of water. Mm-hmm. And they end up falling into this same mania over that money.
You kind of brought this up too by saying, you know, they're very aware, you know, Storm and Norman, their leader, has kind of made them kind of open. They've kind of got this political consciousness about Black history and stuff. But I really love the way the performance was done. I felt like the performance of the veterans was this sort of uneasy mix of being aware of the way they were the ways that they were exploited and the ways that they were treated as Black men and as soldiers, and yet this sort of uneasy pride in being a soldier.
Yeah, that's a weird collision of, like, you know, they're still very proud of, you know, somebody says that Norman was the best soldier that ever lived.
Yep, that's like what I was thinking of.
And he was an American soldier. I mean, he was a black man, but he fired his gun for the United States of America.
Yep. This movie kind of felt like a hand grenade to a certain issue of iconography playing out, which is, of course, the kneeling for the anthem, where it so quickly morphed into, well, it's disrespectful for the troops. It's disrespectful to my father. It's disrespectful to these people. And it sort of felt like the controversy was like as if there were no black soldiers ever.
Yeah, right. Drew Brees gets to say that because his whiteness qualifies him to American history, but
precisely
he plays with men who their grandfathers fought in World War II too, or absolutely, Vietnam or Korea, whatever.
There is not I think we can kind of unpick. I think we do this kind of thing uncritically where it's like, well, there were black troops too, you know? And it can be sort of uncritical of, like, what is the function of war? But you can't pick an American war that didn't have black soldiers. Try it. You can't. As much as we tried in the Revolution to make sure that, you know, the British were given a recruiting bonanza because we were so sure we were going to enforce slavery. I mean, go to if you ever make your way to Boston Commons, you know, the Shaw Memorial, the 54th or 53rd Regiment, you know, it's Shaw leading his men, and, you know, it's the white officer on the horse, but really the impact is just the black soldiers are marching, because this is the first time, right, that they're being given combat duty, and Godin sculpted them all with individual faces. It's powerful. They're not faceless. Yeah. And so it's like, but we're not honoring that. We're not even honoring that in our, you know, our Union War memorials, right? That's the only one I can think of. The rest of them are white men, you know, no color, but their features are white. And so it's like, well, yeah, what does that do? You know, what? So I felt like that was poking exactly at that. You're not as American as I am.
Yeah, and then the movie really worked for me when it when Spike Lee became pedantic with and used that actual and historical footage and almost blended documentary with movie. I wish he would have pushed that further and made it a half documentary, half movie. That would have been, I think, an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. Like the Angela Davis footage and the Muhammad Ali that began the movie, where he was basically, and I always loved this Muhammad Ali, where he was like, why would I go shoot someone that I don't know for people who have treated me like shit the majority of my life? It just resonates. That should make sense to people, anyone.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously, we're not going to say it here, but the power of the, what you know, Lee's words, Muhammad Ali's words, the very famous phrase, is just like, how can you refute that, you know? And it's...
That's when the movie did work for me. When the movie didn't work for me was when there were a couple of really obvious beats that Adam kind of talked about as being cliche. But also, you know, this is a weird thing to talk about with a movie, but, you know, we are dissecting it. When the movie went in, changed aspect ratio and went into TV mode for the flashback, I love that. But the score almost became like this television heroic, almost like 1970s score. It almost took me out of the movie.
Interesting. Because I was going to, that was one of the things I was going to telegraph. I felt like the score mutated with what it was depicting. Yeah. And I felt like the score fit with, you know what, it reminded me of nothing more than watching, was it 2 or 3 years ago, Ken Burns' Vietnam? Yes. Or these other documentaries I've seen. That's what it, you know, and it kind of underscored for me the essential artificiality of these kind of iconic images and memories, and, you know, which I think he also did by having the actors, which I loved, the old men with the only one of them who never got older. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that.
That was, I did just, too.
The repetition of that and the flashbacks just ended up being incredibly powerful to me.
I thought that was great. And there's also the juxtaposition of, you know, they got to live. That's the obvious thing, but they're still haunted by this memory. But also these are, they were men when they were there, but now they are like what our society has deemed, you know, older, wizened, all these kind of things that come with age. Yet they still are living by the words that Norman, Chadwick Boseman's character, told them when they were all in their early 20s. Which is kind of an odd, you're living by a young man's logic, not to say that he wasn't right all along, but there's something about, you know, we don't probably believe the same things we did when we were college age. You know, you learn and grow. But for them, this was obviously heightened circumstances, but just interesting that it was almost biblical to them, to the way that they tried to lead their lives.
I was thinking about that too at the end of the movie, with like, how old could his character really have been? Like 25, right? They're all college age because they didn't go to college. So they got drafted or whatever and sent to Vietnam. And, you know, there was just, I feel like anything I talk about with this movie, I'm almost talking about 5 different movies.
Exactly.
Because there's things like, you know, when they're talking about Storm and Norman and he flips the grunt out on the first patrol talking about, you know, right, the first time in the jungle, right, you're talking about your sweetheart back home, and then they just get wiped out by you, and then you get wiped out, or you step on a landmine, or the Viet Cong wipe you out, and he totally flips that with you know, having the American soldiers kill these Vietnamese guys who you can actually hear what they're saying instead of it just being
foreign-y,
you know, this kind of foreign-y scary sounding. So it's like there's the stuff that he's doing there. There's the, I mean, you know, we haven't even touched the performances.
No,
which we haven't. One towering one in particular was, you know, Delroy Lindo's performance was just, you want to talk, he was having his Colonel Kurtz moment there.
Mm-hmm.
Almost.
He was amazing.
Coming apart at the seams. He was incredible.
People have pointed out a lot of the time when you get to these moments in any survival kind of movie, it's somebody coming apart, but that was a man reaching enlightenment by the end. You think he's kind of gone crazy, but it's all a path to that. I don't know. It was an interesting, you're talking about kind of flipping expectations. That certainly was the reverse of what you may have expected.
So Spike kind of moving the camera so that it's, you know, he's probably walking back with Delroy, Paul looking right into the camera and kind of giving this which starts out with him, this whole sequence sort of starts before they cut into it with him, like, scream sobbing the 23rd Psalm, which was incredible. And then him staring into the camera the Roger Ebert .com review I read last night, because it was very instructive for some of those things. He pointed out that Humphrey Bogart's character in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is wandering around kind of delirious and paranoid. They're all after me. They're going to get me. And like Adam said, in this scene, he's kind of paralleling that, but he's getting more clear until he just, and that it gave me chills the way he played it. And Chadwick Boseman, man, did he have like 6 lines? And he was great in every scene he was in, especially right there at the end.
He was amazing. That ending scene was so powerful.
Yeah.
I don't know what bigger point he's trying to... The more that I pull at this movie, the more complex it seems.
Absolutely. Right.
I knew that would be the case for me coming in today, that I would talk myself into it, liking it a whole lot more. I just feel like there was like this... There was this really perfect movie in there, and that's the one I wanted, I think. But still great, though. I realize its greatness a lot more. No, go ahead.
I think the thing that I took a long time, because like if you had taken me maybe even 5 years ago, I think I would have said, I like Do the Right Thing, and I don't like any other Spike Lee movie. And I think I've come around to being like, he doesn't make perfect movies. And I think part of that is because he's a swing for the fences guy. He's swing for the fences, go for broke, leave it all on the table, right? Leave it all on the field. And it's kind of like, do I want like someone trying for like timid perfection, or do I want someone like making big swings?
Yeah.
Do I want someone who's, and I think like coming around to being like, is it perfect? No. Are there movies he's made that I think are bad? Yes. Is he always trying? Is he never stopping? And is he fascinating? Absolute. And in this case, he was just fascinating.
I mean, as a YouTube fanatic myself, I have to say,
yeah, I like this one
for the fences, guys.
Like the big, messy, you know, get your cast together, put your spin, and like this one, there were 100 little, like we haven't even talked about, like what the hell was going on with the, you know, in the modern scenes, right? The ratio changing because they're like shooting it through an old camera, right? What was going on there? I've got some thoughts about how it's their ghosts and their memory intersecting. I could be wrong. It could not work.
Well, interesting. Yeah, there was
a ton of good stuff there.
He was carrying a film camera and like an old point and shoot kind of film video camera. Mm-hmm. That made me question, what year is it? And then they would show current day Vietnam. Yep. You're also kind of trying to work out, these dudes went out in the jungle and humped it around for a few days. They're not young men at all. The characters, I don't know if what the actors' ages, if they line up, but...
Delroy Lindo is 67, and I think the rest of them are around that age. So yeah, they're not young dudes anymore. This was Spike Lee's Wild Hogs, I think.
Well, I knew watching it in the middle of this movie, very early in the movie, maybe. I was thinking this is a big swing movie, which is, of course, that's a Spike Lee fingerprint. I think that's a fingerprint of a Spike Lee joint. So it's on Netflix. The Five Bloods. Reserve some time. You guys go out there. You listeners. Go reckon with this movie, and I feel like I might have to reckon with it even more. Like Donovan said, it's not necessarily the greatest movie of all time, but it's got a lot going on that's worth thinking about. So that's my final take. Any final thoughts? You want to go around and we'll wrap up?
We haven't mentioned how great all of the cast was. And Delroy Lindo obviously leading the way. I think that should be up for, I don't know what award season will look like, but he was...
Yeah.
He was incredible. But Clark Peters, longtime favorite here, still very good.
Yep.
It took quite a bit. He would have been a star of the show in any other movie. I don't know. I thought it was great. I thought the one beat that kind of lost me, even though it was still fun, and this is a very swing for the fences kind of cliche, use your cliches to your advantage kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The shootout at the end. It's kind of like, yeah, there's a lot of headshots happening. You know what I mean? But also, who cares? He's making a point. So,
yeah.
Yep.
But that would be my only small gripe.
Gotcha.
It's funny you brought it up because it was kind of the climactic action scene, and it worked, and you know I didn't hate it, but also the shootout was like, yeah, it was fine.
I'm saying this about a movie that I loved. Yeah,
exactly.
Very, very small gripe.
Small quibble. Yeah, you brought up the cast over and over was what I kept thinking. Just the cast and the guy who was the DP for this was also the guy who did. He's done a lot of work. But he did Three Kings and Drive, which I thought was kind of interesting. So I just thought a lot of really great, interesting camera work. So just from like, if you like thinking about how people, and I think you always get that with Spike, because he's not afraid to say, I'm completely breaking with realism and I'm going to have a character monologue right looking you in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you like, and especially if you like thinking about like what worked and what didn't, like he's a great filmmaker for that. But I'd like to point out how much I enjoyed Jonathan Majors' role as a performance as David. It's got me really excited to see.
He was so good.
It's got me really excited to see. He was in a really good movie last year, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which I would highly recommend. Anyone hasn't seen it. But also, he's going to be the main lead in Lovecraft Country. Coming out on HBO in August, I believe. Jordan Peele produced, based on a book, kind of mixing these ideas of like Lovecraft's monsters, but also his racism and American racism and sundown towns and the Green Book, right? So as cursed as that is to say now with that movie. So I'm really excited for that now, having kind of seen him in this role. Also, Walter Davis Hanson, or whatever his name is, in the background, just as the guy clearing landmines, like that man got an Oscar nod and he's happy to just pay his dues for the rest of his life. Good for him.
That's good recap of the cast, which we didn't have as much time to explore, but yeah. So Defy Bloods is on Netflix. That's good. It's good stuff. We'll come back at you next week, next Tuesday, and we'll probably try to dissect some of Perry Mason's mysteries. I imagine we'll touch on those a little bit. That show is probably going to have a lot going on in it as far as mysteries are concerned. And what we'll do, we'll try to post online. So follow us online on social media and we'll let you know maybe ahead of time what it is we'll be covering next Tuesday besides a check-in with Perry Mason.
And you know what we're getting close to here is the end of the challenge.
That's right. We will definitely have.
We're on the downhill side of that.
I can't wait.
Yeah, we may even devote a special episode to the challenge. We'll figure out some of those things. Check back in with us next Tuesday, folks. We'll have even more. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you all soon.